This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. Your source for Pan-African news and world developments, I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Jean Bosco Mutangana, the prosecutor general, told the news conference today that his office was not satisfied with the acquittal.
That's reporter Eugene Uimana in Kigali. Will have the latest developments on the acquittal of opposition politician Diane Rugawa coming up. Also, Namibia looks for balance as the country seeks foreign investments. The number of people who have contracted Ebola in eastern DRC hits 500. Also in the DRC, at least two people died today in a clash with police near a rally for an opposition presidential candidate. We'll have these stories and more all ahead on Africa News Tonight. Rwanda's national prosecutor says his office will appeal the acquittal of opposition politician Diane Rugara and her mother by the High Court. Rugara was cleared of all charges, which she claimed were politically motivated. Eugene Uimana has details from Kigali.
Jean Bosco Mutangana, the prosecutor general, told the news conference today that his office was not satisfied with the acquittal. I believe the prosecution has enough evidence to prove the criminality of the duo, which was disregarded by High Court, and I can confirm that we have read the full judgment and will be appealing because we are still within the 30 days set by the law to appeal. The case of Rugara and her family sparked international concerns about the human rights and freedom of opposition politicians in Rwanda. The prosecutor general said that's not an issue, adding that his office works in the interest of all Rwandans to fight impunity. Whether this will take a political turn or not, that is for someone else to worry about. My job as a prosecutor is to put on a gown and go to court to present the evidence I have on a suspect. Our Rwandans need to live in a free crime society. Since the arrest, the Rwigaras have insisted that they have been targeted for expressing their thoughts about the ruling party's alleged failure is handling the country. Diane Rwigara's sister Anne told VOA that the incarceration was unjustified.
Because it was not necessary. You do not get incarcerated for your opinions or your ambitions. We should be free to express and think what we want.
Last week, the High Court returned a not guilty verdict on all charges against Diane Rwigara and her mother, citing insufficient evidence. They were accused of inciting insurrection, and Diane Rwigara faced separate forgery-related charges. Eugene Uimana for VOA News, Kigali.
Foreign investment is key to employment and economic growth in Namibia, which, according to its National Planning Commission, had an unemployment rate of 36% in 2017. However, Namibia's government must balance the interest of outside investors seeking the highest possible profits against the demands of Namibian citizens who want their fair share of their country's vast resources. To find out more, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Kale Schetwein, Namibia's Minister of Finance, who was in New York this week to court American investors.
So the idea was to, yes, explain that Namibia is a safe investor's home. We have peace, we have stability, we have a very reliable judicial system, we have got good infrastructure, we have a very well-functioning and sophisticated financial system. The financial sector is very well integrated, but we still have social issues and problems that we have to solve. And our investment outcome must be utilized and leveraged to solve those social issues that we have.
Why don't you go into a little bit about the challenges that you face? Give us a look at something that you need to be transparent about in terms of encouraging investment.
Social inequality or economic inequality is a global phenomenon. And its root causes are, in our opinion, in the liberal free market system that has overemphasized shareholders' profits to the detriment of social equality. And we believe that coming out of a very unequal society of apartheid, that cannot be maintained. We don't want to depart from free market systems where people can own things and where we have not a command economy. But we have to tweak that liberal free market model to a mixed economy model where we efficiently and meaningfully erode inequality. We have had 29 years of independence and inequality is still harsh and prevalent. The possibility, if we keep the status quo, for the majority of our youngsters to be better off than their parents is limited. So we must do something better where the wealth creation is shared better and more broadly in the population.
How does that work out in practical terms?
Yes, of course, that is always the big question. How do you bring that about? We believe that the best and the most efficient tool is through social welfare. It is not easily possible to hand out chairs to people or to give away economic opportunity or whatever. We believe that, yes, access to economic opportunity is one side of it. But the most vulnerable are not served well if they get a package of shares. They need to be helped with a social program that brings about skills development, that brings about their ability to be employed. And that is where the main emphasis will be.
Do you think that there is an inherent contradiction between the free market capitalist model where everybody makes as much profit as they can and they're motivated to invest because they want to make money, and this idea of equality between people so that the amount of capital that they bring to the situation isn't a determining factor in how well they thrive?
Well, if you sit in an economy that is basically a primary sector-bound economy, your chances to have leverage on how you share wealth is in any case limited. We therefore need to have a better grip on the value share that can be distributed better. It's therefore a combination of things. It's not only how economic access to our riches is shared, it is also how the value add is better shared with the citizens.
It's a very difficult line to walk because you want to lure investors into Namibia who may not share these arguably more egalitarian ethos. I mean, how do you handle that?
It is a difficult line to walk, but one has to take the decision. You know, if there are investors that are not prepared to share at all, maybe they are not good investors to have. And we believe there are many of these investors around that believe that it is actually better to earn slightly less, but still enough to make a good living and have the population in the society where you work also benefiting from your being there.
That was Namibia's finance minister, Kale Schwetwein. He spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips this week in New York. The number of people who have contracted Ebola in eastern DRC has hit 500, including 289 deaths. Officials say the outbreak is likely to last 6 more months and could drag on longer if the deadly virus spreads to neighboring countries. Uganda already has started to vaccinate health workers, and South Sudan will follow in the next few days. There also remains concerns about breaks in the containment effort when attacks in the affected area, which also is a conflict zone, force aid workers to stay indoors. The World Health Organization is considering wider use of the new Ebola vaccine, which has been given to people who came in contact with those who have contracted the virus, but a wider vaccination program could strain the available supply. In more news from the DRC, at least 2 people died today in a clash with police near a rally for opposition presidential candidate Martin Fayulu. Journalist Kahozi Kosha reported for VOA Swahili service was at the rally in Kalemie, and he says several people were injured when police fired on the crowd. The clash came a day after 2 Fayulu supporters were killed and at least 43 were hurt when clashes broke out in Lubumbashi. Fayulu is the main opposition candidate in the race to replace President Joseph Kabila, who was constitutionally barred from running again. Kabila chose Emmanuel Ramazani Shadari as his favored candidate. In Libya, planning is underway for the coming national conference. The chairman of the Libyan High Council of State, Khalid al-Mishri, and Tahir al-Juhami, Minister of Planning of the Government of National Accord, have met with the UN Special Envoy to Libya, Ghassan Salame. But the House of Representatives and the Libyan High Council of State remain at odds over amendments the House wants, but the Council considers unconstitutional. Rhiannon Smith is managing editor of Libya Analysis based in London. She explained to VOA senior analyst Mohammed Elshenawi the challenges facing the Libyan National Conference.
The planned national conference in Libya, which is expected to take place sometime early next year, has managed to gain some momentum and traction on the ground in Libya. And it very much seems to be the main kind of political process and main political goal of the main players in Libya at the moment. However, this is mainly centered around Fayez al-Sarraj, the head of the Government of National Accord, and he has really been able to strengthen his political and economic and military power from his center in Tripoli. Actors like Khalid al-Mishri and some of the other GNA ministers, although they are keen to show that they support the national conference and are keen to be a part of it, they are quite worried that actually they are not the main players anymore and that they may be left out. Therefore, they are attending a lot of these meetings to try and show willing to the international community.
The UN mission in Libya prepared files of proposals from visits to 77 Libyan cities aiming at unifying Libya. Would that bring about a consensus in the upcoming national conference?
This process, I think, is a very valuable process. And I think having all of this feedback and these voices as part of the planned National Reconciliation Conference will make it much more effective. The difficulty is how they will go about that, and that's what is not yet clear in terms of the agenda and the structure of the National Conference, how they're going to bring all of those different voices together and then what they will then do with them. There is a danger that if they have this nice report that has all these all this feedback and these opinions, but actually they don't do anything with them, that many Libyans will actually feel that the conference is no more than a show for the internationals and that nothing will actually change. So in short, I think it could be a very good, solid starting point for the conference if it's handled in the right way and given the time that it needs.
On the negative side, there are still disputes between the House of Representatives and the Libyan High Council of State over amendments circulated by the House of Representatives perceived by the Council as unconstitutional. Can you clarify those differences and could they derail the National Conference?
Yes, so this has become almost a bit of a sideshow to the National Conference in the last couple of months. And in part, this is because both the House of Representatives and the High State Council are panicking. They're worried that this new process is going to make them irrelevant and will eventually lead to them being disbanded. What the HOR has done is, in order to have the referendum on the Constitution, the referendum law that they produced required that instead of the referendum or the draft Constitution requiring a two-thirds majority from the whole of Libya, their referendum law said that not only did it need a two-thirds majority in total, but that each of the three regions, so Fezzan, Cyrenaica and Tripolitania, must also pass the draft constitution by a majority of 50 or 50 plus 1%. This is what the Khalid al-Mishri and the High State Council are objecting to, because this is seen as making it very unlikely that the referendum would be passed because it has such a high threshold. Now, the HOR last week said that they had gone back and actually they amended this to allow the referendum to take place on this basis. In reality, if the constitutional referendum goes ahead as planned, to begin with, it's likely to face a lot of legal challenges, not only from the High State Council, but from many others who see the HOR as just pushing this ahead without the legal grounds to do so. It's also possible that this could act as quite a divisive event, that it could actually undermine any of the reconciliation work which is going to be taking place at the National Conference.
That was Rhiannon Smith, managing editor of Libya Analysis. She spoke with VOA's Mohammed Elshenawi. You're listening to Africa News Tonight, live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington. African journalists recently converged in Johannesburg under the auspices of the U.S. Department of State's Office of Citizen Exchanges for the Business of Truth Conference. It focused on current trends in new media and investigative journalism and how digital information technologies are reshaping journalism, communication, and society. Journalist Addie Gondo has more.
The Business of Truth Conference drew delegates from across Africa and beyond. The event was implemented by World Learning and coordinated by the Digital Communication Network. One session looked at how African governments are making moves to muzzle press freedom in social media. The digital frontier is set to emerge as the new battlefield for freedom of expression, a matter which concerns members of the journalism fraternity. Michael Kaluba, a broadcast journalist from Zambia, speaks on his country's moves to curtail media freedom.
Recently, there was an introduction of a statutory instrument which introduced what they are calling internet levy, which basically means for anybody to use social media, they will have to pay this small amount towards government. Other issues that have been working against media freedom in the country include a very archaic law that was made part of the constitution way before Zambia even attained independence. And it's the Public Order Act. Under the Public Order Act, the police have the mandate to even, walk into a radio station or a TV station and stop a program that is running because they don't, subscribe to what is being aired.
Some media industry professionals, such as Tara Tickington from South Africa, who was a speaker at the conference, believe that new media presents opportunity for innovative media professionals.
I think there's some very worrying signs on the continent. Mm-hmm. Places that are asking you to pay to register a blog, for instance, it's a form of suppression or oppression of the media. But journalists are resourceful. They are entrepreneurial, and the truth will out. It's very difficult to control social media. It is extremely difficult. Where journalists are finding the ways to report the news, sometimes from outside the borders of that country, if that's what they're forced to do.
Observers say that given the fact that 77% of Africa's population is under 35 years of age, this demographic is the one which is using new media the most. They also say that though social media is good for them, the efforts to limit freedom of expression by some African governments such as Zambia, Uganda and Zimbabwe are detrimental to the continent's progress as the spread of information is a pillar of all development trajectories. Reporting for VOA, this is Andy Gondo.
Tanzania's President John Magufuli and Egyptian Prime Minister Mustafa Madbouly today signed a deal for construction of a $3 billion hydroelectric dam on the Fufiji River in Tanzania. The dam is expected to more than double the country's electricity production capacity. Egypt's El Sebedi Electric Company and Arab contractors will lead the project. The Nigerian Immigration Service has warned immigrants not to vote in next year's general elections. The service says it has retrieved 700 permanent voter cards from immigrants. Recently, a top Immigration Service official met with leaders of ECOWAS citizens and other foreign nations who live in Lagos State. He urged members of their organizations not to participate in the elections or to take part in political party activity. Ferdinand Otto is a senior lecturer in the Department of Political Science at the University of Lagos. He spoke with reporter Mike Mbonye and says allowing immigrants to participate in the 2019 elections could be a threat to national security.
That is a very welcome development. It's the most challenging aspect of our security in the conduct of election. There's always been this allegation, people from neighboring countries coming to come and participate in our election. But the truth of the matter is that who issued this voters' card to them. It shows that the process of registration is porous. That is what it means. Because if you are to register and they ask you some basic questions, your local government and all those things, they should be able to, from there, dictate that this person is not a Nigerian and that person should not be given voters' card. But the unfortunate thing is that I don't want to accuse the immigration because they are not involved in the registration of voters. But at the same time, it is their duty to ensure that immigrants into the country have the necessary documents. One of the major problems is that we have so many porous borders. Those that are unmanned are more than those that are manned, and that poses a very great challenge to immigration services. The transnational crimes that we hear about in West African sub-region, especially within the Sahel and the neighboring countries, those electoral regions and so on, those borders are very porous, and that gives room for these foreigners to infiltrate in our electoral process.
Do you think the immigration service should reach out to the political parties not to use immigrants or vote for them?
Well, the political parties are looking for ways to win elections. So that aspect may not be visible. But because if we really want to give credence to our electoral process, if we really want to make it more credible, then of course political parties should not even engage in such art. They should not. Whether PDP, whether APC, whichever political party, they should not engage in such art because you're undermining our national security. You're undermining our national security. I would have shared an experience I had, an encounter in the process of registering for national ID card some time ago. And a Liberian I know walked in and went to register. And I walked in there when he left. I said, this person, do you know where you come from? And this person is a Liberian, but he has lived in Nigeria, schooled here, and so on. So you understand the system. But you should have probed further to know actually where you come from. So that is a major problem. It's a national security threat. So the political parties that will connive with foreigners to come and undermine our electoral process, that political party is guilty as the foreigners themselves.
Do you also think that the service should check the immigrants in the local government areas against participated in the elections?
Yes, of course. Since they have been able to run to this level of retrieving some of those voters' cards, they can also go a step ahead by ensuring that each of the local governments that their members are supposed to go around to ensure that the foreigners do not take part in the electoral process. And of course, the INEC itself as an institution that is umpire should educate its members, not allow foreigners to come and vote in whichever disguise, whether the APC is desperate to win or PDP is desperate to win the election, they should not, because it undermines our national security. It is very, very important. It's a threat, so we should not encourage it.
And that was Ferdinand Otto, senior lecturer in the Department of Political Science. He spoke with reporter Mike Mbonye in Lagos, Nigeria. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and thanks for choosing the VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
The astronomical phenomenon called the fast radio burst, or FRB, is just that, a very quick but powerful blast of radio waves from across the universe. Since FRBs are so quick and pop up randomly from sources all across the sky, astronomers were only able to detect about 25 of them between 2007 and 2016. But new technology offered by the Australia Square Kilometer Array Pathfinder has allowed astronomers to find 20 new FRBs in just 1 year. These recent fast radio burst detections are said to include the closest and brightest fast radio bursts ever detected. While scientists still don't quite know what causes them, they theorize that the amount of energy released by FRBs is quite powerful and could be equivalent to the amount of energy the sun releases over an 80-year period. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Hello, I'm Douglas Simpoga, host of VOA's Reporters Roundtable. Join us every Thursday as we discuss important African topics and events. I'll have a panel of African journalists and expert guests to discuss the topic at hand. We take a deeper look at important African news topics. That's Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
Join your host, Larry London, for Border Crossings, VOA's Worldwide Music Request Hour, every weekday at 1500 Universal. Tune in to hear your favorite songs and artists, win prizes and giveaways, and get the latest scoop from exclusive celebrity interviews. Send in requests to our Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram, or call 202-618-2077 to have your favorite music played for the entire world. Don't miss Border Crossings every weekday at 1500 Universal.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 1630 and 1830 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.